The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, Concluded.
Cassette 9, Side 1.
There was a joke, except it wasn't a joke, to the effect that Denikin wanted to fight for the Soviet Union against Hitler, and that at one time Stalin planned to arrange his return to the motherland, not for military reasons, obviously, but as a symbol of national unity. During the German occupation of France, a horde of Russian émigrés, young and old, joined the resistance. And after the liberation of Paris, they swarmed to the Soviet embassy to apply for permission to return to the motherland. No matter what kind of Russia it was still Russia. That was their slogan, and that is how they proved they had not been lying previously about their love for her. Imprisoned in 1945 and 1946, they were almost happy that these prison bars and these jailers were their own, Russian. And they observed with surprise the Soviet boys scratching their heads and saying, "Why the hell did we come back? Wasn't there room enough for us in Europe?" But given that Stalinist logic which said that every Soviet person who had lived abroad had to be imprisoned in camp, how could the émigrés possibly escape the same lot? In the Balkans, Central Europe, Harbin, they were arrested as soon as the Soviet armies arrived. They were arrested in their apartments and on the street, just like Soviet citizens. For a while, state security arrested only men, and not all of them, only those who had in one way or another revealed a political bias. Later on, their families were transported to exile in Russia, but some were left where they were in Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia. In France, they were welcomed into Soviet citizenship with honors and flowers, and sent back to the motherland in comfort. And only when they got to the USSR were they raked in. Things dragged out longer for the Shanghai émigrés. In 1945, Russian hands didn't reach that far. But a plenipotentiary from the Soviet government went to Shanghai and announced a decree of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet extending forgiveness to all émigrés. Well now, how could one refuse to believe that? The government certainly couldn't lie. Whether or not there actually was such a decree, it did not, in any case, tie the hands of the organs. The Shanghai Russians expressed their delight. They were told they could take with them as many possessions as they wanted and whatever they wanted. They went home with automobiles. The country could put them to good use. They were told they could settle wherever they wanted to in the Soviet Union and, of course, work at any profession or trade. They were transported from Shanghai in steamships. The fate of the passengers varied. On some of the ships, for some reason, they were given no food at all. They also suffered various fates after reaching the port of Nakhodka, which was, incidentally, one of the main transit centers of Gulag. Almost all of them were loaded into freight cars like prisoners, except that they had as yet no strict convoy and there were no police dogs. Some of them were actually delivered to inhabited places, to cities, and allowed to live there for 2 or 3 years. Others were delivered in trainloads straight to their camps and were dumped out somewhere off a high embankment into the forest beyond the Volga, together with their white pianos and their jardinières. In 1948 to 1949, the former Far Eastern émigrés who had until then managed to stay out of camps were scraped up to the last man. As a 9-year-old boy, I had read the small, dark blue books of V.V. Shulgin with more interest than I had read Jules Verne. At that time, they were sold openly in our bookstalls. His was a voice from a world that had disappeared with such finality that not even the most extravagant fantasy could have projected that invisible point in the soundless corridors of the big Lubyanka where his steps would intersect my own before 20 years had passed. True, I would not meet the man himself until another 20 years had gone by. But I had time to study attentively many émigrés, old and young, in the spring of 1945. I underwent a medical examination with Captain Borshish and Colonel Mariushkin, and the pitiful sight of their naked, wrinkled, dark yellow bodies, not bodies any longer but mummies, has always remained before my eyes. They were arrested 5 minutes this side of the grave, so to speak, and brought to Moscow from several thousand miles away, and there in Moscow in 1945 an interrogation was proceeding in the most serious way on their struggle against Soviet power in 1919. We have become so used to the piling up of injustices during interrogation and trial that we have ceased drawing any distinctions of degree between them. This captain and this colonel were veteran officers of the Tsar's Russian army. They had both been over 40, and they had both served in the army for 20 years, when the telegraph brought them news that the Tsar had been overthrown in Petrograd. For 20 years they had served the Tsar according to their oath. And now, against their wills, for all we know, possibly muttering, "Beat it! Scram!" to themselves, they swore loyalty to the provisional government. After that, no one asked them to swear any more oaths because the whole army fell apart. They didn't like the new scheme of things wherein soldiers tore shoulder boards off officers and killed them, and it was natural for them to join other officers to fight against it. And it was natural for the Red Army to fight against them and push them into the sea. But in a country in which at least the rudiments of jurisprudence exist, what basis was there for putting them on trial? And a quarter of a century later at that. They had lived as private persons all that time, Mariushkin up to the very moment of his arrest. Borshish, to be sure, had turned up in a Cossack wagon train in Austria, but in a transport with the old men and women, not in an armed unit. However, in 1945, in the very center of Soviet jurisdiction, they were charged with actions directed toward the overthrow of the government of the workers and peasants Soviets, armed incursion into Soviet territory, in other words, not having immediately left Russia when Petrograd was declared Soviet, aiding the international bourgeoisie, which they had never seen even in their dreams, serving counter-revolutionary governments, that is, their own generals, to whom they had been subordinate all their lives. And all these sections, numbers 1, 2, 4, 13, of Article 58, were included in a criminal code adopted in 1926, that is, 6 to 7 years after the end of the Civil War. This was a classic and unconscionable example of the ex post facto application of a law. In addition, Article 2 of the Code specified that it applied only to citizens taken into custody on the territory of the Russian Republic. But State Security's strong right arm had grabbed people who were in no wise Soviet citizens from all the countries of Europe and Asia. On this basis, no single African leader has any assurance that we will not, 10 years from now, promulgate a law in accordance with which we will put him on trial for what he does today. Yes, the Chinese, in fact, will promulgate precisely such laws. Just give them the chance to reach out that far. And we won't even bring up the question of statutes of limitations. This question was provided for very flexibly. No statutes of limitations applied to Article 58. Why stir up the past indeed? Such statutes are invoked only in the case of our homegrown executioners, who have destroyed many, many more of their compatriots than did the whole Civil War. Mariushkin, at least, remembered everything clearly. He told us the details of being evacuated from Novorossiysk.
But Borscht had already descended into second childhood and prattled on and on about celebrating Easter in the Lubyanka. He had eaten only half his bread ration during Palm Sunday week and Holy Week, and had set the rest of it aside, gradually replacing the stale pieces with fresh ones.
Thus he had accumulated 7 full rations when it came time to break the Lenten fast, and he had feasted for the 3 days of Easter. I do not know what kind of white guards they were in the Civil War, either of them, whether they were among the exceptional few who hung every 10th worker without trial and whipped the peasants, or whether they were the other kind, the soldierly majority. The fact that they were being interrogated and sentenced in Moscow was no proof of anything, nor a matter of any consequence. But if, from that time on, they had lived for a quarter of a century, not as retired officers on pensions and with honor, but as homeless exiles, then how could anyone point to any moral basis for trying them? That is the kind of dialectic Anatole France mastered, but which we cannot seem to grasp. According to Anatole France, by the time it's today, yesterday's martyr is already in the wrong. In fact, from the first minute the red shirt covered his body, and vice versa. But our version is, if they rode me for 1 short year when I had just outgrown being a foal, Then I am called a riding horse all my life, even though I have long since been used only as a cab horse. Colonel Konstantin Konstantinovich Yasevich was very different from these helpless emigre mummies. For him, clearly, the end of the Civil War had not ended the struggle against Bolshevism. As to how he continued to struggle, where and with what, he did not enlighten me. But the sense that he was still in the service remained with him in the cell itself. In the midst of all the chaotic concepts, the blurred and broken lines of vision, in most of our heads, he had evidently a clear and exact view of everything around him. As a result of this reasoned point of view on life, his body, too, exhibited a steady strength, resiliency, and activity. He was certainly not less than 60. His head was totally bald, without a single hair. He had already survived his interrogation and was awaiting his sentence, like the rest of us. He could expect no help from anywhere, of course, but he kept his young, even, rosy skin. Among all of us in the cell, he alone did exercises every morning and washed himself at the faucet. The rest of us were trying not to squander the calories in our prison ration. He put his time to use, and whenever an aisle opened up between the rows of board bunks, he paced those 15 to 20 feet with a precise stride and a precise profile, crossing his arms over his chest and staring through the walls with clear, young eyes. And the difference between us and him was that we were all astonished at what was happening to us, while nothing around him contradicted his expectations, and precisely for that reason he was absolutely alone in the cell. A year later, I was able to appraise his conduct in prison. Once again, I was in the Butyrki, and in one of those 70 cells I met some young co-defendants of Yasevich, who had already been sentenced to 10 and 15 years. The sentences given everyone in their group were typed out on cigarette paper, and for some reason they had it in their possession. Yasevich was first on the list, and his sentence was to be shot. So that was what he saw, what he foresaw, through the wall with his still young eyes as he paced back and forth from the table to the door. But his unimpaired consciousness of the correctness of his path in life lent him extraordinary strength. Among the emigres was one my own age, Igor Tronko. We became friends. Both of us were weak, dried out. Our skin was grayish-yellow on our bones. Why had we collapsed to such an extent? I think the main cause was spiritual confusion. Both of us were thin and on the tall side, and we were shaken by the gusts of summer wind in the Butyrki courtyard. We always walked side by side with the careful steps of old men and discussed the parallels in our lives. He had been born in South Russia the same year as I. We were still nursing babes when fate stuck her hand into her well-worn purse and drew out a short straw for me and a long one for him. So it was that he rolled off across the sea, even though his white guard father was just a rank-and-file, unpropertied telegrapher. I found it interesting in the extreme to picture through his life all those compatriots of my generation who had landed outside Russia. They had grown up under good family supervision and in very modest, even meager, circumstances. They were all very well brought up and, within the range of existing possibilities, well educated. They grew up without knowing fear or oppression, though the white organizations maintained a certain yoke of authority over them until they themselves grew strong. They grew up in such a way that the sins to which all European youth was subject in that period, a high crime rate, a frivolous attitude toward life, thoughtlessness, dissipation, did not touch them. That was because they grew up, so to speak, in the shadow of the indelible misfortune which had befallen their families. Whatever country they grew up in, they looked on Russia alone as their motherland. Their spiritual upbringing was based on Russian literature, all the more beloved because to them it was the beginning and end of their motherland, because for them their motherland did not exist as a primary geographical and physical fact. The contemporary printed word was much more generally accessible to them than to us, but they received Soviet books in conspicuously small quantities. And they felt this lack all the more keenly. It seemed to them chiefly responsible for their inability to understand what was most important, highest, and most beautiful in Soviet Russia. And that the books they did receive presented a distortion, a lie, were incomplete. The picture they had of our real life was very, very faint, but their longing for their motherland was such that if we had called on them in 1941, they would all have joined the Red Army, and it would have been even sweeter for them to die than to survive. These young people from 25 to 27 already represented and firmly defended several points of view in definite conflict with the opinions of the old generals and political leaders. Thus, Igor's group was called the Nepredrashensi, the non-prejudges. They declared that anyone who had not shared with the motherland the whole complex burden of the past decades had no right to decide anything about the future of Russia, nor even to presuppose anything, but should simply go and lend his strength to whatever the people might decide. We would often lie beside one another on the wooden bunks. I tried to understand his world as best I could, and our encounter revealed to me a concept confirmed by later encounters, that the outflow from Russia of a significant part of her spiritual forces, which occurred in the Civil War, had deprived us of a great and important stream of Russian culture. Everyone who really loves that culture will strive for the reunion of both streams, the one at home and the tributary abroad. Only then will our culture attain wholeness. Only then will it reveal its capacity for benign development. And I dream of living until that day. A human being is weak. Weak. In the end, that spring, even the most stubborn of us wanted forgiveness and were ready to give up a lot for just a little bit more life. An anecdote was current among us. What is your last word, accused? I beg you to send me wherever you please, just as long as it is under the Soviet government and the sun is there. No one was threatening to deprive us of the Soviet government, of course, just of the sun. No one wanted to be sent beyond the Arctic Circle to scurvy and malnutrition. For some reason, a legend about the Altai region in particular flourished in the cells. Those rare persons who had been there at one time or another, but especially those who had never been there, wove melodious dreams about the wonderful country of the Altai for their cellmates. It had the vast expanses of Siberia and a mild climate, rivers of honey flowing between banks of wheat, the steppe and mountains, herds of sheep, flocks of wildfowl, shoals of fish, populous, rich villages. Does not the prisoner's dream of the Altai simply continue the old peasant dream about it? The so-called lands of His Majesty's cabinet were in the Altai, and because of this the area was closed to colonization much longer than the rest of Siberia. But it was there that the peasants wanted most of all to settle, and where they actually settled. Is it not from this that the enduring legend has arisen? Oh, if only we could find a hiding place in that quiet. If only we could listen to the pure resounding of the cock crow in the unpolluted air, or stroke the good, serious face of a horse. Curses on you, all you great problems. Let someone else beat his head against you, someone more stupid. Oh, just to rest there from the interrogator's mother oaths and the monotonous unwinding of your whole life, from the crash of the prison locks, from the suffocating stuffiness of the cell. Only one life is allotted us, one small, short life, and we had been criminal enough to push ours in front of somebody's machine guns, or drag it with us, still unsullied, into the dirty rubbish heap of politics. There, in the Altai, it appeared, one could live in the lowest, darkest hut on the edge of the village next to the forest, and one could go into the woods, not for brushwood and not for mushrooms, but just to go for no reason and hug two tree trunks. Dear ones, you're all I need. And the spring itself sounded a summons to mercy. It was the spring that marked the ending of such an enormous war. We saw that millions of us prisoners were flowing past and knew that millions more would greet us in the camps. It just couldn't be that so many people were to remain in prison after the greatest victory in the world. It was just to frighten us that they were holding us for the time being, so that we might remember and take heed. Of course, there would soon be a total amnesty and all of us would be released. Someone even swore that he had read in a newspaper that Stalin, replying to some American correspondent, whose name I cannot remember, said that after the war there would be an amnesty the like of which the world had never seen. And one of the interrogators had actually said to someone else that there would soon be a general amnesty. These rumors were a help to the interrogators because they weakened the prisoner's will. The hell with him. Let's sign. It isn't going to be for long anyway. But for mercy, one must have wisdom. This has been a truce throughout our history, and will remain one for a long time to come. We did not heed the few sober minds among us who croaked out that never, in a whole quarter century, had there been an amnesty for political prisoners, and that there never would be one. Some cell expert among the stool pigeons leapt up with an answer. Yes, there was, in 1927, for the 10th anniversary of the revolution, all the prisons were emptied, and white flags were flown on all of them. This astonishing vision of white flags on the prisons, why white, was particularly striking. Vyshinsky presents the figures. In the 1927 amnesty, 7.3% of the prisoners were amnested. This is a credible figure, pretty poor for a 10th anniversary. Among the political prisoners, women with children were freed, and those who had only a few months left to serve. In the Verkhno-Uralsk prison isolator, for example, 12 out of the 200 prisoners there were released. But in the middle of it, they regretted even this wretched amnesty and began to block it. They delayed some releases, and some people who were freed were given a minus restriction instead of full freedom to go where they pleased. We brushed aside those wise individuals among us who explained that millions of us were imprisoned precisely because the war had ended. We were no longer needed at the front. We were dangerous in the rear, and were it not for us, not one brick would ever get laid at the remote construction projects. We were too self-absorbed even to grasp Stalin's simple economic calculations, let alone his malice. Just who this year, after being demobilized, would want to leave his family and home and go off to the Kolyma, to Vorkuta, to Siberia, where there were neither roads nor houses? It was virtually the job of the State Planning Commission to assign to the MVD the number of workers required for plan fulfillment, and thus the number to be arrested. An amnesty, a broad and generous amnesty, was what we waited for and thirsted for. Somebody said that in England, prisoners were amnested on the anniversary of the coronation. In other words, every year. Many politicals had been amnested on the 300th anniversary of the Romanovs in 1912, Could it really be possible that now, after we had won a victory which would resound throughout our entire era and even longer, the Stalin government would be petty and vengeful, and would hang on to its resentment of every stumble and slip of each of its minuscule subjects? There is a simple truth which one can learn only through suffering. In war, not victories are blessed, but defeats. Governments need victories, and the people need defeats. Victory gives rise to the desire for more victories, but after a defeat it is freedom that men desire and usually attain. A people needs defeat, just as an individual needs suffering and misfortune. They compel a deepening of the inner life and generate a spiritual upsurge. The Poltava victory was a great misfortune for Russia. It resulted in 2 centuries of great strain and stress, ruin, the absence of freedom, and war again. The Poltava victory spelled salvation for the Swedes. Having lost the appetite for war, the Swedes became the most prosperous and the freest people in Europe. Perhaps only in the 20th century, if one is to believe the stories one hears, has their stagnating well-being led to moral indigestion. We are so used to taking pride in our victory over Napoleon that we leave out of account the fact that because of it, the emancipation of the serfs did not take place a half century sooner. Because of it, the strengthened monarchy destroyed the Decembrists. The French occupation was never a reality for Russia. But the Crimean War and the Japanese War and our war with Germany in the First World War, all those defeats brought us freedom and revolution. We believed in amnesty that spring. We weren't being at all original in this. Talking with old prisoners, one gradually discovers that this thirst for mercy and this faith in mercy is never absent within grey prison walls. For decades and decades, wave after wave of prisoners has thirsted for and believed in either an amnesty or a new code or a general review of cases. And the rumours about these things have always been supported by the organs with skilled caution. The prisoner's imagination sees the ardently awaited arrival of the Angel of Liberation in just about anything. The next anniversary of the October Revolution, Lenin's anniversaries, Victory Day, Red Army Day, Paris Commune Day. Every new session of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, the VTSIK, the end of every five-year plan, every plenary session of the Supreme Court. And the wilder the arrests, the more Homeric and mind-boggling the scale of the waves of prisoners, the more they inspired not sober-mindedness, but faith in amnesty. All sources of light can to some degree be compared with the sun, and the sun cannot be compared with anything. So it is that all the expectations in the world can be compared with the expectation of amnesty, but the expectation of amnesty cannot be compared with anything else. In the spring of 1945, every newcomer to the cell was asked first of all what he had heard about an amnesty, and if two or three prisoners were taken from their cells with their things, the cell experts immediately compared cases and drew the conclusion that theirs were the least serious cases, and they had clearly been taken out to be released. It had begun. In the toilet and in the baths, the prisoners' post offices, our activists looked everywhere for signs and graffiti about the amnesty. And one day at the beginning of July, in the famous lavender vestibule of the Butyrki baths, we read the enormous prophecy written in soap on a glazed lavender slab far higher than a man's head, which meant that one man had stood on another's shoulders in order to write it in a place where it would take longer to erase. Hurrah! Amnesty on July the 17th! Indeed, the bastards were wrong by only one digit. For more details on the great Stalin amnesty of July the 7th, 1945, see Part 3, Chapter 6. What a celebration went on. After all, if they hadn't known for sure, they wouldn't have written it. Everything that beat, pulsed, circulated in the body came to a stop beneath the wave of happiness, the expectation that the doors were about to swing open. But for mercy, one must have wisdom. In the middle of July, the corridor jailer sent one old man from our cell to wash down the toilet, and while they were there, eye to eye, for he wouldn't have dared in the presence of witnesses, he looked sympathetically at the prisoner's grey head and asked, "What's your article, father?" 58. The old man lit up. At home, three generations were mourning his arrest. "You're not included," sighed the jailer. "Nonsense," we decided in the cell. "Just an illiterate jailer." There was also a young man from Kiev in the cell, Valentin. I can't remember his family name. He had big eyes that were beautiful in a feminine way, and he was terrified by the interrogation. There is no doubt that he had the gift of precognition, perhaps only in his then current state of excitement. More than once he went around the cell in the morning and pointed. "Today they are going to come for you and you. I saw it in my dream. And they came and got them." The very individuals he had pointed out. One might add that a prisoner's heart is so inclined toward mysticism that he accepts precognition almost without surprise. On July the 27th, Valentin came up to me. "Alexander, today it is our turn." And he told me a dream that had all the characteristics of prison dreams. A bridge across a muddy stream. A cross. I began to get my things together, and it was not for nothing either. He and I were summoned after morning tea. Our cellmates saw us off with noisy good wishes, and many of them assured us we were going off to freedom. They had figured it out by comparing our less serious cases. Perhaps you honestly don't believe it. Perhaps you won't allow yourself to believe. You can try to brush it aside with jokes. But flaming pincers, hotter than anything else on earth, suddenly close around your heart. They just do. Suppose it's true. They assembled 20 of us from various cells and took us to the baths first. Before every big change in his life, the prisoner has first of all to take a bath. We had time enough there, an hour and a half, to exchange our hunches and ideas. At that point, all steamed up, our skins tender. We were taken through the little emerald park in the Butyrki's interior courtyard, where the birds sang deafeningly, although they were probably only sparrows. and the green of the trees seemed unbearably bright to eyes no longer used to it. Never had my eyes seen the green of the leaves with such intensity as they did that spring, and never in my life had I seen anything closer to God's paradise than that little Butirki Park, which never took more than 30 seconds to cross on the asphalt path. Many years later, this time as a tourist, I saw another similar park, except that it was even smaller, in the Trubetskoy bastion of the Peter and Paul fortress in Leningrad. The other tourists exclaimed over the darkness of the corridors and cells, but I kept thinking to myself that with such a park to walk in, the prisoners of the Trubetskoy bastion were not lost men. We were taken out to walk only in deathly, cell-like stone enclosures. They took us to the Butyrki station, a very well-chosen nickname for that reception and dispatch point, especially because its main hall was really like a good railroad station. They pushed us into a large, spacious box. It was half dark inside, and the air was clean and fresh, since its one and only little window was very high up and had no muzzle. And it opened on that same sunny little park, and through the transom the bird's twitter deafened us, and in the opening a little bright green twig hung, promising us all freedom and home. We had never been in prison in such a good box, and that couldn't be a matter of chance. And we were all cases for the OSOs, the special boards attached to the GPUNKVD. And it turned out that each of us had been imprisoned for nothing much. No one touched us for 3 hours. No one opened the doors. We paced up and down the box, and finally, tired out, we sat down on the slab benches. And the little twig kept bobbing and bobbing outside the opening, and the sparrows screamed as if they were possessed. Suddenly the door crashed open, and one of us was summoned, a quiet bookkeeper, 35 years old. He went out. The door was locked. We started running about our box even more agitatedly than before. We were on hot coals. Once more, the crash of the door. They called another one out and readmitted the first. We rushed to him. But he was not the same man. The life had gone out of his face. His wide-open eyes were unseeing. His movements were uncertain as he stumbled across the smooth floor of the box. Was he in a state of shock? Had they swatted him with an ironing board? "Well, well?" we asked him with sinking hearts. If he had not, in fact, just gotten up from the electric chair, he must at the very least have been given a death sentence. And in the voice of one reporting the end of the universe, the bookkeeper managed to blurt out, 5 years. And once more the door crashed. That was how quickly they returned, as if they were only being taken to the toilet to urinate. The second man returned, all aglow. Evidently he was being released. Well, well, come on. We swarmed around him, our hopes rising again. He waved his hand, choking with laughter. 15 years. It was just too absurd to be believed.
This concludes the reading of Section 1 of the Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1. This book was read by Frederick Davidson. If you would like to receive a free catalogue listing our complete line of audiobooks, write us at Post Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520. Or call, toll-free, 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Will you please wind or rewind the tape as appropriate, so as to present the book in order for the next person to enjoy? Thank you.